Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with Thomas Manton, an exposition with notes upon the Epistle of Jude. Last time we did verse 7, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them, in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on with verse 8. And I'll go ahead and start now. Verse 8, likewise also these filthy dreamers defile the flesh, despise dominion, and speak evil of dignities. So in this verse, you have the apodosis of the former instance. Likewise is the adverb that implies the connection between the two terms of a comparison. They perished that went after strange flesh, so these filthy dreamers that defile the flesh, etc., shall perish. In the words, you may observe, number one, a description of their persons, filthy dreamers. Number two, a discovery of their sins. Two are mentioned in this verse. First, their impurity, they defile the flesh. And second, their tumultuous carriage toward superiors, expressed in two phrases. First, they despise dominions, and secondly, they speak evil of dignities. What these two phrases import is some question. Some think the first notes the judgment and affection, and the second, their speech and practice. Some think two kinds of government are here understood and refer despising of dominion to contempt of magistracy and public government, and speaking evil of dignities to private government and masters, or of masters, 1 Timothy 6:12, which was also despised by these wretches under the pretense of Christian liberty. Others more properly understand the first clause of civil government, usually expressed in Scripture by some Greek word or domination. And the speaking evil of dignities is fitly referred to the traducing and opposing of government and governors, ecclesiastical, as apostles, pastors, teachers, and elders. The officers of the church are called the glory of Christ, 2 Corinthians 8:23, and what we translate speak evil of dignities is in the original speak evil of glories, but of this more anon, or he'll eventually get to it. Let me open the words. So now he's going to go through the words of the verse. Likewise, in the original, there are many words, likewise, notwithstanding. That is, though there be so many and such apparent instances of God's judgment, and those set before us for an example, yet they, being blinded with their wicked passions, are not afraid, but boldly cast themselves upon the hazard of the same ruin. Filthy dreamers, the word in the original is led or inspired or acted by dreams or deluded by dreams. Beza renders it being lulled asleep as noting their security. I suppose rather the dotage of error by which they were, as it were, bewitched and enchanted. Our translation seems to carry it another way as applying it to the nocturnal pollutions because dreaming is joined with defiling the flesh. And Peter charges these persons with rolling their fancies upon unclean objects, 1 Peter 2:14. Or possibly it may be taken literally, the persons here noted pretending to dreams inspired by associate and assistant spirits. The next phrase is defile the flesh, that is, pollute themselves with libidinous practices, 2 Peter 2:10, they walked after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness, and that under a pretense of the gospel. The Nicolaitans taught community of wives, and that it was an indifferent thing to commit adultery, Revelation 2, verses 6 and 14. The Gnostics gave themselves up to all manner of prodigious and incestuous pollutions, whence from their obscenity and beastly life, they were called Borborites. And how many ways they did defile the flesh, we cannot with modesty express. The heathens who made no distinction charged these impurities upon the Christians in general, as if they used the unlawful company of their mothers and sisters, etc. The next phrase is despise dominions. The word signifies to remove a thing out of its place with some scorn and indignation, and so it implies their utter enmity to civil policy and government. 2 Peter 2:10, they despise government, presumptuous are they, and self-willed. Some apply this to the dominion of Christ, which by their fables, the aeones or lords, the lords rulers, they did set at naught, but of that in the fourth verse. But now he speaks of the government of men, and there is an emphasis in the word dominion, which is more than if he had said rulers, for they did not only despise their magistrates or men invested with superiority, but the magistracy itself as a thing unfitting for believers, and such as were made free by Christ to endure. The last part of the charge is they speak evil of dignities, or as it is in the original, blaspheme glories, by which some understand angels, as Clemens Alexandrinus. These impure heretics, devising things unworthy and misbeseeming the angels, but rather I suppose it implies their scorns, curses, and reproaches cast upon the officers of the church, who are the glory of Christ, and the practice is afterward compared with the rebellion of Korah, who rose up not only against Moses, but Aaron in Numbers 11. In the whole, you have a lively description of our modern ranters, levelers, familists, Quakers, who, by dreams, are led on to defile the flesh and to despise all authority, both in church and commonwealth, and that with bitter curses and evil speakings, so that our days afford us but too clear a comment on the expressions of this scripture. It is sadly fulfilled before our eyes. I come to the observations. Observation number one, from that filthy dreamers, note that the erroneous thoughts of wicked men are but a dream. It is but friar-like to follow an illusion too far, only a little for illustration. Wicked men are dreamers. Number one, in regard of their state and condition, every carnal man is in a state of a deep sleep, Isaiah 29:10, snorting upon the bed of ease, without any sense of the danger of their condition, as Jonah in the ship was found asleep when the storm arose. They sleep, but their damnation sleepeth not, 2 Peter 2, verse 3. Number two, in regard of the suitableness between their vain thoughts and a dream. A dream, you know, tickles with a false delight and deceives with a vain hope. Number one, tickles with a false delight. They hug a cloud, as we say, instead of Juno, and embrace the contentments and pleasures of the world instead of the true riches. A carnal man's running from pleasure to pleasure is but a sweet dream, a fit of mirth and pleasure while conscience is asleep. They walk in a vain show, Psalm 39, verse 6. They imagine a great deal of felicity and contentment in their condition, but when they come to warm themselves by their own sparks, they lie down in sorrow, Isaiah 50, verse 11. And number two, deceives with a vain hope, as where the prophet compares the dream of the enemies of the church to the dream of a night vision, Isaiah 29, 7 and 8. And it shall be as a hungry man dreameth, and behold he eateth, but he awaketh, and his soul is empty. Or when as a thirsty man dreameth, and behold he drinketh, but he awaketh, and behold he is faint, and his soul hath appetite. So it is with them, all their hopes are dashed in an instant. The foolish virgins slept, Matthew 25, and when they slept, they dreamed that the door of grace would still be open to them, but they found it shut. Many flatter themselves with fair hopes till they awake in flames, and then all is gone. Take heed, then, of being deceived by your own dreams and the fictions of your own brain. There are no dreams so foolish as those we dream waking, as Epiphanius says of the Gnostics. It was not a sleeping dream that they were guilty of, but the dotage of their minds, putting them upon fancies as monstrous and incoherent as men's thoughts in a dream. Waking dreams are most pernicious. There are two sorts of these dreams. Number one, dreams in point of opinion, when we hug error instead of truth. And number two, dreams in point of hope, when we cherish presumption instead of faith. Number one, dreams and opinion, which are very rife now. The old world is apt to dote, idle, I-D-L-E, and ungrounded notions, how plausible soever, are but the dreams of a misty, sleepy brain. To prevent these, take these rules. Number one, if you would beware of dreams, beware of a blind mind. Men sleep in the dark, and in sleep, fancy gets the start of reason. Indistinct thoughts do easily dispose to error, and a half-light will certainly abuse you. The simple believeth every word, Proverbs 14, verse 15. Number two, suffer not or allow not yourselves to be blinded. First, not by vile affections. Men would fain have the true, which is pleasing, and most accommodate to their own interests. Vile affection takes away the light of reason and leaves us only with the pride of reason, and therefore none so confident and touchy in their opinions as they that are misled by lusts and interests. And lusts often are just corrupt desires of the hearts, more in general. Here we have come from much more of a sexual lust, and so, but they can often mean corrupt desires of their hearts or things for just for pleasure. How easily do we exasperate our minds and invent prejudices against a hated truth? If the weights be equal, yet if the balances be not equal, wrong will be done. When the heart is biased before the search and swayed with carnal desire or interest, the judgment is obscured and cannot consider of the weight of what is alleged. There is an idol, I-D-O-L, in the heart. Secondly, by vulgar prejudice, that the devil may keep the world asleep, it is his usual trick to burden the ways of God with clamor and vulgar prejudice. A dream or a lie dares not combat with truth in open field, and therefore fortifies against it with popular arguments, that the ways of God may be suspected rather than tried. And usually it falls that error is more specious at the first blush, God's providence suffering or allowing his own ways to be under the cross and the world's displeasure. Now, in such a case, men keep at a distance and are loath to search, lest they meet with trouble of conscience for not obeying the truth, or trouble from the world for crossing their customs and fashions. And thirdly, by personal administration in spiritual things, we learn to dream from one another, Deuteronomy 13:3 and Zechariah 10, verse 2. No man must be set up in God's chair, and their dictates followed as if they were infallible. Study the word, else there is no light in what is brought to you, Isaiah 8, verse 20. It is but only a dream and dotage of men's brains, and the closer you keep to the letter of the word, the better. Many are perverted by mystical interpretations when men bring that to the word which they do not find there. The letter must not be receded from as long as it is capable of any commodious interpretation. Now this word must be hidden in the heart, Psalm 119, verse 9. Dwell in us richly, Colossians 3, verse 16. And that was number one under observation one, dreams and point of opinion. And number two, there are dreams in point of hope. And so number one, some wholly or fully mistake in the object and dream of an eternal happiness in temporal enjoyments, Psalm 49, verse 11, and so Luke 12, 19, Revelation 18, verse 9. Number two, others dream of attaining the end or purpose without using the means. They live in sin and yet hope to die comfortably and go to heaven at length for all that, as if it were but an easy and sudden leap from Delilah's lap to Abraham's bosom, and the pleasures of sin for a season would be no hindrance to the enjoyment of the pleasures at God's right hand forevermore. A vain dream, see Luke 16:25 and James 5, verse 5. Three, others make mistake about the means because they have a cold form. They are apt to be conceited of their spiritual condition and estate, Revelation 3:17. If you would not dream in this kind, examine your hearts often. Examination is like a rubbing of the eyes after sleep and reviving of conscience the recollection of our dreams. A man laughs at his dreams when he is awake, and when fancy is cited before the tribunal of God, vain apprehensions fly away. Again, be sober and watchful, 1 Peter 5, verse 9, and 2 Thessalonians 5, verse 6. Confessing sin, it is telling our dream when we are awake and come to ourselves. Observation number 2. From that defile the flesh, observe that dreams of error dispose to practices of sin and uncleanness, and impurity of religion is usually joined with uncleanness of body, which comes to pass partly by the just judgment of God, who punishes spiritual fornication with bodily. Hosea 4, 12 and 13, they have gone a-whoring from their God, therefore their daughters shall commit whoredom and their spouses adultery. That is God's course, that the odiousness of the one may make them see the heinousness of the other, see Romans 1, 24. Partly by the influence of error, it perverts the heart, a frame of truth, preserves the awe of God in the soul, and a right belief makes the manners orthodox. All sins are rooted in wrong thoughts of God, 3 John verse 11, either in unbelief or misbelief. Unbelief is the mother of sin, and misbelief the nurse of it. It springs from distrust and is countenanced by error. Partly because the design of most errors is to put the soul into a liberty which God never allowed. Some errors come from the pride of reason, because it will not veil and strike sail to faith, but most come from vile affection. A carnal heart must be gratified with a carnal doctrine. 2 Peter 2:19, they promise liberty, etc. Errors are but a device to cast off Christ's yoke and to lull the conscience asleep in a course of disobedience. Well then, avoid error of judgment if you would avoid filthiness of conversation, conversation being behavior of life. Men first dream and then defile the flesh. Abominable impurities, unless temper of nature and posture of interests hinder, are the usual fruit of evil opinions. Truth is the root of holiness. Sanctify them by thy truth. Thy word is truth. John 17:17. God's blessing goes with his own doctrine. 1 Peter 1:22. Again, those that have taken up the profession of a right way of religion should beware of staining it by such kind of practices. Nothing makes the ways of God suspected so much as the scandals of those that profess to walk in them. Walk in the light as children of the light, Ephesians 5. Otherwise, you will be a reproach to the truth and deprive it of its testimony. Observation 3, again, observe that sin is a defilement. It stains and darkens the glory of a man, Matthew 15:20. This defilement was implied in the washings of the ceremonial law and in baptism. We are washed as soon as we are born because we are sinners as soon as we are born. Now, that may be baby baptism he's talking about there. And just an aside, I don't personally agree with baby baptism, but that may be why he said it that way. Going on, surely that they that glory in sin do but glory in their own shame. It is but as if a man should boast of his own dung and count his spittle an ornament. When you count graceless swearing, mightiness to drink, revenge, pride, a glory to you, you do the same. There is nothing makes us stink in God's nostrils but sin. Psalm 14, verse 3, they are altogether become filthy. So much sin as you have about you, so much nastiness. Gain is pleasant to those that are taken with that kind of lust or corrupt desire of the heart, but the scripture calls it filthy lucre, 1 Timothy 3, verse 3. All sins are compared to filthy garments, Zechariah 3, verse 4, and Jude 19, and Isaiah 30, verse 22. Desire to be washed, and that thoroughly, Psalm 51, verse 2. Observation number 4, again observe that of all sins, the sin of uncleanness or unlawful copulation is most defiling. It defiles the whole man, but chiefly the body, and therefore it is said they defile the flesh. It stains the soul with filthy thoughts, Matthew 15:20. It stains the name, Proverbs 6, verse 33, but in a singular manner it pollutes the body, 1 Corinthians 6:18. In all other outward sins, though the body be the instrument, yet it is not the object of them. All other sins do abuse as a drunk, so like a drunkard does, or wine, an epicure with meats, a worldling with riches. All these are objects without us or outside of us. But here the body is not only the instrument, but the object. Romans 1:24, God gave them up to uncleanness to dishonor their own bodies. So see 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 4. It wastes the strength and beauty of the body, Proverbs 5, 9 to 11. It hinders our serviceableness and does not consider that the body is consecrated to God, Romans 12, verse 1, and 1 Corinthians 6:15, a temple of the Holy Ghost, 1 Corinthians 6:19, interested in the hopes of glory, Philippians 3:21, and therefore puts it to so vile a use as to be an instrument of lust. Christians, shall those eyes which are consecrated to God to behold his works be windows to let in sin? 2 Peter 2:14. That body which is the Holy Ghost's temple be made the member of a harlot and so wasted in the service of lust as to become a clog to us and wholly or fully useless as to any gracious purposes? Are not your beauty, health, strength, concernments too good to be spent upon so vile an interest? Take heed, then, of all uncleanness, both conjugal, consisting in excess and immoderation of lust in the married estate, etc. You may not be drunk with your own wine, nor quench the vigor of nature by excess in those pleasures which the laws of God and men do allow you. And also of uncleanness adulterous, which is more brutish, when men scatter their lusts promiscuously without confinement to one object. So you're also not allowed to use lawful things immoderately. Observation number five, from that despised dominion, observe that errors, especially such as tend to sensuality, make men unruly and anti-magistratical. Dreamers that do defile themselves do also despise dominion. Now this comes to pass partly from the permission of God's wise and just providence, who suffers such miscarriages to awaken the magistrate to a care of truth, if not in zeal for God's glory, yet out of a sense of his own interest, and upon reason of state, the commonwealth being troubled by those who first began to trouble the church. New doctrines put men after an itch upon new laws, and false religions are usually turbulent, and partly because persons loose and erroneous would free themselves from all awe, both of God and man, as it is said of the unjust judge that he feared neither God nor man, Luke 18. So with those men, error takes off the dread of God, and sedition the dread of the magistrate, that so they may more freely defile the flesh. God has two deputies to keep a sinner under awe, conscience and the magistrate. Now false doctrine benumbs conscience, and then that all authority may be laid aside, the rights of the magistrate are invaded, that as conscience may not stand in the way of their lust, so not the magistrate in the way of their sin. That there was anciently such libertines in the church appears by Galatians 5:13 and 1 Peter 2:16 and 1 Corinthians 7:20-23. Vain man would fain be free and yokeless, neither would he have his heart subject to God, nor his actions to man's censure. Partly because all errors are rooted in obstinacy, and that will bewray itself, not only in divine and spiritual, but in civil things, see 2 Peter 2:10, but chiefly them that walk after the flesh in the lust of uncleanness. Presumptuous are they and self-willed, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Usually errors sear the conscience and give the sinner a front and boldness so that God is not only dishonored, but civil society is disturbed, as Nazianzen observes, of the Arians. They began in blasphemous language against Christ, but end in tumultuous carriage against the peace of the commonwealth. For, he says, how often we hope that they will spare men that would not spare God. Often it falls out that they that please not God are also contrary to all men, 1 Thessalonians 2:15, partly because opposition to magistracy is a kind of indirect blow and aim at God, and that either as it is his ordinance, Romans 13, or a kind of resemblance of his glory, I have said you are God's, Psalm 82, verse 6. So that it is a contempt of God in his image and picture. Look, as under the law God forbade men cruelty to the beasts, as not to destroy the dam from the young, to see the kid in the mother's milk, and that such kind of prohibitions might be as a fence and rail about the life of man, so respect to magistracy is a kind of fence about his own dignity and divine glory, God's. Magistrates being representative gods, therefore, through their sides, they strike at God himself. Not obviously actually gods, but representatives of God himself. Partly because the end of magistracy is to suppress evil, Romans 13, verse 5. An infinite speech is equivalent to a universal in a matter of necessary duty, and the universal particle is expressed everywhere, Proverbs 20, verse 8, a king that sitteth upon the throne of judgment scattereth away all evil with his eyes, all evil that falls under his cognizance, all evil, whether it be of a civil or a spiritual concernment. We must not limit and distinguish where the word does not. I know there be some that do defalcate and cut off a great part of that duty which belongs to the magistrate, confining his care only to things of a civil concernment, but preposterously, truths according to godliness belong also to his inspection, upon which ground we are bound to pray for them, that they may come to the knowledge of the truth, 1 Timothy 2, verse 2, and under them we may lead a quiet life in all godliness and honesty, where it is plainly implied that the converted magistrate is to look to the countenance and maintenance of godliness as well as honesty. Well then, sensual heretics being doubly obnoxious, as sensual as venting errors, no wonder that they rise up in defiance of God's ordinance. Use number one, it shows us the evil of inordinate lustings. We may learn hence whence or from where they proceed, and whither they tend or to where they tend. They proceed from the pride and obstinacy of error. Men dream and are then licentious, and it tends to the casting off of all duty to God and man. Nip this disposition in the bud. It is in all our natures. Man is born like the wild ass's colt, Job 11:12, not only for rudeness of understanding, but untamedness of affection. We love to break through all bonds and restraints as if none were lord over us, Psalm 12, verse 3. Use number two, it informs us what will be the issue when libertism abounds, even an utter confusion. The ruin of the public weal is brought on by pestilent and evil doctrines. I believe Socrates might have said that on Ecclesiastes 4:11. So our divines at the Synod of Dort said something similar. Tully, in his book De Legibus, said that the glory of Greece presently declined when the people were given to evil manners and evil opinions. Let us lay these things to heart. I do not love to envy against the times and to indulge the petulancy of a mistaken zeal, but the king's danger made Croesus' dumb son to speak. Use number three, it may take off the prejudice that is often cast upon religion and the true ways of God. It is not truth that troubled Israel, but error, 1 Kings 18, verse 18, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye forsaken the commandments of the Lord. It is an old slander that strict religion is no friend of commonwealths. As soon as Christianity began to fly abroad in the world, it was objected against her as if it was prejudicial to civil power and greatness, thereby to defeat her of the patronage of princes and to hinder them from becoming nursing fathers, Isaiah 49, verse 23. Magistracy, being that power which is left, able to suppress or advance religion, the devil strives all that he can to incense it against her, the church, or against religion. There is a natural and wakeful jealousy in princes over their dignities and prerogatives, and therefore the enemies of the church have ever sought occasion to represent the people of God as enemies to their just power. So Christ was accused in Luke 23, verse 2, and Paul, Acts 24, verse 5, but altogether without cause. It is true, if religion be not kindly received, it brings a judgment there where it is tendered, as the ark, when it was irreverently handled, brought a plague upon the Bethshemites, 1 Samuel 6, verse 19, but yet a blessing upon the house of Obed-Edom. So religion, when it is worthily treated, brings a blessing, otherwise a judgment. Let the world say what it will, it is a friend to magistracy, partly by its commands enforcing civil duties by a sacred bond and obligation. See Proverbs 24, 21, Matthew 22, 21, 1 Peter 2, verse 17, and Ecclesiastes 8, verse 2. Partly by its influence, meekening the hearts of men and obliging them to faithfulness. Those that are faithful to God, I shall expect them to be faithful to me, said Constantine's father. Certainly none live so sweetly under the same government as those that are united in the same faith or cemented together with the same blood of Christ. Partly by those indulgences of God's providence, who is wont or often to favor those states where true religion is countenanced and vigorously owned. Oh, that our magistrates would regard this. Their wisdom lies in kissing the sun, S-O-N, Psalm 2, verse 10. Christ came not to gain persons, but nations to his obedience, and the more that is effected, though it be but by a public profession, the more safety may they expect. It is but a necessary thankfulness of the powers of the world to him to whom they owe their crowns, Proverbs 8, verse 16. Let us pray for them that God would raise their zeal and make them more cordial in the support of religion. A heathen said, either wholly abandon religion fully or maintain it more entirely. Use number 4. It shows us what little reason magistrates have to countenance and spread their skirt over obstinate and impure heretics, such spirits being usually most opposite to magistracy. They do but nourish a snake in their own bosoms and cherish a faction that in time will eat out their bowels. Were there no respects of religion, but only those of civil policy, they should not be so sleepy in this case. But you will say, is it lawful for them to intermeddle in matters of religion and to use any compulsive power? I answer, yes, verily, they bear not the sword in vain. We have frequent instances in the word of good kings whose zeal is commended for so doing, and frequent injunctions also to this purpose. The Levites are commended for assisting Moses in the execution of those that worshipped the calf, Exodus 23:26-28. Abraham was to command his children, Genesis 18:29. Asa commanded Judah to worship God, and the thing was right in the eyes of the Lord, 2 Chronicles 14:2-4. So see 2 Chronicles 15:23 and Ezra 10, verse 8. So Chronicles 34, verses 32-33. And that promise in Isaiah 43, verse 23. I know I touched the sore, S-O-R-E, of this age, and that this is a truth much prejudiced. Therefore, I shall first remove the prejudices and then state the question. First, remove the prejudices. The first is taken from the fathers or primitive Christians who almost generally expressed themselves against planting religion by the sword and compulsive force. As a footnote, Augustine changed his mind twice and was at last for compulsion or in favor of it. So that's what they thought generally back then. I answer, were religion now to be planted, these sayings would take place. Pagans are not to be compelled, but enlightened, taught, not destroyed. And yet in such a case, it is a question not easily resolved whether the magistrate, if he had power, were not bound to compel his people, though professed pagans, to hear or attend upon the ministry of the word, it being the ordinary means of working faith. Augustine determined that a Christian in such a case should improve his power for Christ. It is a favor that the magistrate will take care to bring them to the means of salvation. Again, in such a case, they are to be kept from scandalizing and blaspheming the true religion. That is the least a magistrate can do for Christ. But where a people are Christianized and do profess true religion, they should not be set free to atheism, error, and apostasy. Number two, another prejudice is that the examples before mentioned are brought from the Old Testament and so proper to the policy of the Jews. So that's what someone will say in his answer. I answer, some alleged were before Moses' law and that of Abraham and Jacob's commanding his family to put away their idols, Genesis 35, verse 2. And the injunctions in the Old Testament were built upon reasons of immutable equity as God's glory, the danger of infection, etc. And so concern us as well as them. And the thing in question is agreeable to the light of nature, there being instances of pagan princes who were so far convinced of their duty to the true God that they enjoined his worship, punishing the contempt thereof. See Ezra 6, verses 11, Ezra 7, 26, and Daniel 3, verse 29. The Gentiles, by the light of nature, saw it to be suitable and agreeable to right reason. Aristotle said, first thing that falls under a magistrate's care is a care of divine worship. The Athenians banished Protagoras for speaking doubtfully and by way of extenuation of their religion and burnt his books. Besides all this, the reason why we have only precedents in the Old Testament is because the people of the Jews were the only state that were acquainted with the knowledge of the true God. We have some prophecies that the like should be done in the New Testament, Isaiah 49:23, Zechariah 13, which concerns gospel times, Isaiah 60 verse 10, Revelation 21:24. We were worse provided for than they were in the Old Testament if men that had the plague sore of heresy running upon them should without restraint be permitted to come into all companies. Number three, another prejudice is, or an argument against, it will make men hypocrites. I answer with Athanasius, would to God all were got so far as hypocrites, it would certainly be better for the Christian world. But however, duties must not be left undone for ill consequences. Number four, and another prejudice is, this will make way for persecution and the calamities of the godly upon every change of the prince's mind. I answer, if the Lord see persecution necessary for the church, we must endure it, and so we shall by gainers both by good princes and bad. By the persecution of evil princes, truth is made glorious. By the majesty of the good, error is suppressed and discountenanced. God would oblige us the more to pray for them in power. Psalm 72, verse 1 and 1 Timothy 2, verse 2, and he has promised to hear such prayers and provide nurse fathers for the church. Sometimes a wicked magistrate, understanding his duty, may, by the overruling power of God in his conscience, be withheld from persecuting the truth, yea, carried out to the suppression of error. When Paulus Samosatinus revolted from the Orthodox Christian faith and would yet retain the bishopric of Antioch, the business was brought to Aurelian, a pagan emperor, who removed him. And that was the going through the prejudices. And secondly, I shall state the point and show you how far compulsion is necessary. Number one, the magistrate should use no compulsion before care had for better information and resolution of the doubting conscience. Otherwise, the practice were fell and cruel, like that of false religions that brook no contradiction. Consciences scrupulous must not be too hardly dealt with all, or dealt with all. To answer arguments by a prison or the fires is a popish topic, and to supply in rage what wants or lacks in strength of reason and clearness of light is but a butcherly violence. Punishment and compulsion should not be hastened as long as there appears a desire to be informed with meek endeavors after satisfaction. The Apostle Paul is for two admonitions before church censure, Titus 3 verse 10, and the censure of the magistrate should not precede that of the church. Number two, in things indifferent, Christian toleration and forbearance takes place. All men never were, nor ever will be, in this world, of one and the same opinion, no more than the same feature and complexion. There is a due latitude of allowable differences wherein the strong should bear with the weak, Romans 15, 1, Ephesians 4, 2, 4 verse 2, and Galatians 4, verse 1. There are some lesser mistakes of conscience and infirmities incident to all men, namely, such as are consistent with faith, the main and fundamental truths and principles of salvation and charity, as not tending to foment faction in the church or sedition in the commonwealth. But if either of these limits be transgressed, circumstances may make the lesser things intolerable, as Paul withstood Peter to the face, though otherwise he did not count the matter great, Galatians 2 verse 11. Yet, when it was urged to the scandal of the churches, he thought it worthy of a contest. And here it belongs to Christian princes as to defend truth, so to see that peace be not violated for rites and ceremonies and lesser differences that lie far from the heart of religion. I am persuaded that want or lack of condescension to brethren has brought all this confusion upon us, etc. Number three, a gross error kept secret comes not under the magistrate's cognizance, but the diffusion and dissemination of errors he must take notice of, as when men infect others and openly blaspheme Christian doctrine, he beareth not the sword in vain. The mind and conscience as to any power under God is sui juris, or thoughts are free. It is a saying in the civil law, all command is exercised about such things as fall within the knowledge of him that commands. Now, God only knows the heart. Theodosius and Valentinian, in their law concerning the heretic, give this limitation that subscriptions and inquisitions into men's consciences we cannot but justly condemn. Number four, errors, according to their nature and degree, merit a different punishment, Jude verse 9 and Ezra 7 verse 26. Number five, blasphemy, idolatry, and gross heresy are to be put into the same rank with gross, vicious actions and supposed, if entertained after the receiving of the truth, to be done against light and conscience. Paul said of the heretic that he is, some Greek word, after due admonitions, I guess, is that maybe anathema or something? Titus 3 verse 11. Therefore, in some cases, these may be punished with death, as Baal's prophets were slain, 1 Kings 18, verse 40, Exodus 21, verse 20, Leviticus 24, verse 16. But of the whole question elsewhere, I guess maybe he will or has spoken of it elsewhere. All right, and that was the end of observation number five and the uses there. Observation number six, again, I observe from the same clause that it is a sin to despise dominions. For it is here charged upon these seducers. It is a sin because it is against the injunctions of the word, Romans 13, 1 and Titus 3, verse 1. We are apt to forget our civil duties or to count them arbitrary, as if the same authority had not established the second tables, the second table of the Ten Commandments, as well as the first. And it is a sin because magistracy is God's ordinance. The general instruction of it is of God, though the particular constitution of it be of man. Compare Romans 13:1 with 1 Peter 2:13. Government itself is of God, but this or that special manner or form of government is not determined by God, which is the difference between civil and ecclesiastical government, for there the particular form is specified in ecclesiastical or the church, as well as the thing itself appointed. Again, it is a sin because dominion preserves human societies so that we should trespass against the common good and public order if we should despise this help, yea, against the law of our own nature, man being by nature a sociable creature. Well then, let us obey every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, at least obviously the ones that aren't against what the Lord commands. The public welfare is concerned in our obedience, as also the honor of religion, both which should be very dear to one that fears God. The public welfare better bear many inconveniences than embroil the country in war and blood. We are bidden be subject to the froward, 1 Peter 2:18. In the honor of religion, God will have the world know that Christianity is a friend to civil policy. See 1 Peter 2:15 and Matthew 17, verse 27. We learn hence, too, that they are but libertines that think that religion frees them from the subjection which they owe to God or man. It does not exempt us from our duty, but enable us to perform it. Many take such liberty in civil things that they begin to grow contemptuous even in divine, and so cast off God's yoke as well as the magistrates. And observation number 7, the last expression is that speak evil of dignities or of glories, by which probably church officers are intended, such being spoken against in that age, 3 John verse 10, and expressed by the word glories, a term given both to the apostles and other officers of the church. Note, there is a respect due to persons invested with church power. This is established by God's ordinance and therefore should not be set at naught or to nothing. Neither should the persons invested with it be evil spoken of. That obedience is required to them, see Hebrews 13:17, and respect and honor, see 1 Thessalonians 5:12 and 13, and 1 Timothy 5:17, that they should not be lightly evil spoken of, 1 Timothy 5:19. Though for their persons in outward estate they are mean or low and despicable, yet they are called to a high employment and have the promise of a great power and presence with them. Matthew 16:19, John 20, verse 23. Their regular proceedings are ratified in the court of heaven. We are fallen into an age wherein no persons are more contemptible than ministers, nothing less valued than church authority. It has become the eyesore of the times. Not to speak of those barking Shimeis, the Quakers, and their foul-mouthed language taught them by the father of lies. Surely others have not such a reverence of God's ordinance as they should have. All right, and that is the end of verse 8. And Lord willing, we will plan to go on next time. But until then, go in pondering these things about the civil magistrates and church authority. And may we be obedient as we should be with God's help. And may we pray for those in authority over us, even in families and everywhere that might be. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.